Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here, with our guest today, Mike Gelfand, best remembered as the KQRS Morning Show personality for, what, Mike, about 25 years on the show?
Yeah, managed to, about 25 years, managed to do about 25 years, yeah.
And you've not been on the show for about 3 years, but many people remember you for your days at the State Fair, and also what I remember, the Stretch and Z show from the Midwest Sports Channel, which a few of us still remember the old MSC before it became Fox Sports North.
Yeah, those were the halcyon days.
So, Mike, you've had quite a different career spanning, I hate to embarrass you, but 3 decades in Twin Cities media, going back from being a writer at the Minneapolis Star, correct?
The Tribune,
I apologize.
Yeah, those were the glory pre-merger days.
And
those two papers were, they were always a lot different. The Tribune had a reputation as kind of a writer's newspaper. And the Star, not quite so much. And when the papers merged, they really seemed to me underwent kind of a sea change. Writers were considered to be kind of a nuisance. If you were a writer, you were perceived as caring what they did to your copy. And so the whole kind of cold temperature in the room changed. And luckily for me, I'd been there. I'd already been there 10 years. Talk about going back a ways. I'd already been there 10 years. So it was that was actually a good thing because the papers merged and us old timers got great deals if we wanted to leave, because of course they had to pare down the staff. So that I sort of at that point failed my way into radio.
You're a pretty young guy to be an old timer taking a buyout from the Minneapolis Tribune. And also, to keep in context, this was an era where people in St. Paul didn't get the Minneapolis paper and people in Minneapolis didn't get the St. Paul paper. I think today...
That's true.
It's pretty much we have two Twin Cities papers, like the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times. Right in the era where you were writing, and a lot of other columnists who have found their way into radio and other media, it was very two distinct papers. And then also the Pioneer Press and the Dispatch were two different papers, and of course the Star and the Tribune. So there really was 4 competing papers in the area, which employed a lot of writers, which in this era of digital media, it's hard to imagine.
When I left the Tribune, I was hanging around on a Friday afternoon, and I asked a buddy of mine. I said, "Say that buyout thing where they're offering us a year of pay and 5 years of medical insurance to leave." He said, "When does that expire?" And he looked at his watch and he said, "About 10 minutes."
Yeah.
So I went into the managing editor's office and said, "All right, I'm out of here." I can honestly say that I was not greeted as a hero when I returned home that night.
Not a lot of tears on your way out the door, though, from you, right?
I think it was a great time to leave, but it was a sinecure. You had that job, and you pretty much had it for life. And I left with 3 kids and not knowing what the heck I was going to do. So it was a little scary, but it was fine. And the first thing I did was I started writing a football picks column, because the God bless them, the people at the Skyway News were willing to give me medical insurance in exchange for the column. So I didn't need the medical insurance quite then, but later on I did. So that was a great thing for me. But eventually they were purchased by Bob Lertzema, and it became Bob Lertzema's Viking Report. And at that time I had to reflect, because that was about 12 years after I had gotten out of college and began writing for the Wall Street Journal. So you can imagine how humbling it is to go from the Wall Street Journal to Bob Lertzema's Viking Report.
And those on the audience here, that's Benchwarmer Bob, in case you aren't sure.
Benchwarmer Bob, yeah. So that was one of the great riches to rag story, I thought. I mean, it was kind of like one step away from living in a vagrant motel above Moby Dick's.
Was it health insurance and a free clock when Benchwarmer Bob took it over? I think he used to hawk those quite a bit.
That's how long ago it was, when banks would give you the free clock or the toaster oven. Actually, Bob and I did a series of radio spots for Twin City Federal, as it was called then, just coincidentally.
Well, I'm looking at the Amazon listing for you, by the way. And in case you don't know, there's quite a bit of books that you wrote. It must have been after your newspaper days here, including the Jeffersons TV series story. Billy Joel, who's going to do a concert here, but Rock and Pop Stars by M. Howard Gelfand.
There was a Billy Joel one?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that. I mean, I knew, obviously, at some point, but I've long since forgotten that. Yeah, some guy, nice guy. He was publishing kids' books. I think he was out of Mankato. And about 3 days after I left the paper, he said, "Hey, do you want to do a series of kids' books?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, why not?" But that was what it was like in those days. You would just take anything that came over the transom. And I was lucky that a lot of stuff came over the transom. But I think that first year I had something like 85 W-2 forms because there were a lot of people who wanted me to do a lot of little stuff like that. And my favorite project was editing and writing a gynecology newsletter.
Well, I mean, it pays the bills and keeps the family fed, right?
I can honestly say that neither then nor now I really had the background to do it.
Well, coming so close to the holidays, you know, I'm looking, for our producer here for a Christmas gift. It's been tough to decide, and I think it's between Herschel Walker by Howard M. Gelfand, which,
by the way,
new is $2,400 on Amazon, but used is $12.99. The Jeffersons TV book is only a penny. This is used, so we might pick that up. I think shipping will be more than getting the Jeffersons book here.
Yeah, but I would say a penny's about right, though. But what about my Deadpool book?
You know, I don't see it online. It must be sold out right now. I've been searching for that one.
That one was a fun project. I like my buddy Mike Wilkinson, who's a PR man by trade. He had the idea, and we teamed up to do it. And we did a bunch of radio interviews. We did some local appearances at bookstores and kind of waited and waited. And finally, it was like a year later, I get the envelope from the publisher, and I rip it open, you know, because I'd been waiting for my royalties for a year, and it was a bill for $34.
Right. Well, that goes to show that no good deed goes unpunished, right?
No, I was told that very few people bought it, but there were some people who stole it. So,
well,
I don't know.
At least people had interest. The way, for those who might be listening who don't know what the Deadpool is, it's not the Clint Eastwood movie. It is actually a bet you might take at the beginning of the year that celebrities, and I think that the rules are modified by office to office. I know on KQRS, our competing radio station here to KLBB, but on KQRS, you actually had it wasn't someone on death row, and it wasn't someone that no one had heard about.
Well, the basic rule we had was that they couldn't be famous simply because they were about to die.
Right.
And, of course, if someone was 104 years old, we would interpret that as being famous because they were about to die. So we'd have like five listeners who would participate, and they would compete against me. And I think we each took five candidates. And it got very exciting because, of course, as each day passes, the people you pick have a greater chance. The odds are greater that they'll die. So even if you have, even if you're trailing by a couple deaths, say in mid-December,
the cold and flu season starts.
You've always got a shot because, for one thing, as I say, there's this incremental chance that people will die, and then the other thing is, of course, you're getting into the heart of cold and flu season.
You know, this is really warming up the holiday spirit here over at KLEB here. But there's some names, and I'm not to be too cryptic and discuss this topic too long, but there are some names I remember 15 years ago that were on that list that are still on there, that people still show up year after year.
Those are the sucker picks, the Hoover picks, you know, people who you say, Mamie Eisenhower is one of the classics. I mean, I knew a guy who took Mamie Eisenhower every year for like 17 years. And I think she finally passed away at about 104. But it was kind of funny because the last year we did it, we had become people of a certain age ourselves, and I was discussing with Dave Hamilton the Deadpool, and it's always been kind of an enthusiastic thing we did. And Dave looked up at me, and I think we were discussing our latest doctor's appointments, and he said, "You know, this Deadpool thing isn't really quite as much fun as it used to be."
No, when you're in the generation that is the nursing home generation, and this can be anywhere from 39 to 100, it gets a little bit scarier every year. But no, and again, I'll move up this topic because I'm sure our listeners are very in tune to this. But I remember when Jaja was on back in 2000, and we still believe she's with us. Correct?
Oh, absolutely. No question.
You were a media columnist before you left the Tribune, and we have a lot of your articles up on tcmedianow.com with some great illustrations. And you were writing for TV News when it was really the golden era of TV News.
You know, it really was. Locally, I think that we had a very intense TV news scene, and of course it was at the time, and I suspect maybe a little less so, but still to some extent, very lucrative. Because it was the return on capital invested was tremendous. Obviously today they're not getting nearly the kind of money they were getting for a spot, but in those days it was terrific. So you had the top anchors, people like Ron Majors and even actually his brother Paul. After that, they were making enormous sums of money. I think probably quite a bit more than those guys are making today.
At least compared to incomes what they were making today. They were commanding very high salaries, big contracts. Those are a long gone era.
Yeah. There were guys that were making, I think, close to $500,000 at least or more.
And you were making about $400,000 a year, right? Doing the, critic, correct?
Union scale.
Yeah, right.
Nothing wrong with the union scale.
No. And you did you make a lot of friends or enemies when you were doing the media critic? It's tough to because you. I remember Nick Coleman one time said it was tough to be able to actually have dinner with anyone after a while because the people if you're in the media and then you're associated with media people, no one wants to talk to you if you're being critical of them.
It was amazing how many calls I would get though from people who were interested in planting an item and also talking to station executives, the things they would sort of casually say, usually defaming some competitor. It worked both ways, but it's generally true about people in the media, and I'm talking now about not just TV people. It's probably double true for newspaper reporters that their egos are not always healthy. They've got egos about as thin as a 25-cent slice of corned beef.
Well, we used to have that. We had the governor here for a while too. That he, luckily, he didn't have a big ego or anything. Who was a media guy, but then he ended up not liking the media.
No, well, I think that probably is a pretty typical story. I knew Jesse long before that, when he was kind of transitioning from his wrestling days. He was a delightful guy, and you could joke around with Jesse, and then of course he. For some reason, he started taking himself seriously, and that was the end of that.
I kind of believe your persona is your real, really you. That's where I think it takes problem. I know that, and I'll ask you this question. Do you think that people, they came to town here, and pretty soon they started buying their own, they buy in their own persona?
It just goes with the territory. You become what you're pretending to be. And one of the things about the KQ morning show, do you mind me saying that, by the way?
Well, we can say that, yes.
Okay. One of the things about the morning show was that the success of the show was, I think, entirely because of the fact that we were completely ourselves. And people would always say, how did you adopt that persona? And, of course, I hadn't done any radio before then. I really honestly didn't know what they were talking about. I could not possibly have been anything except what I was, and that was true of everybody on the show, and that's one reason Tom and I would have such intense arguments, because we weren't doing that. Well, your listeners, a lot of your listeners of a certain age, so I can make this allusion, that we were not out of the Boone and Erickson mode. How's it going, Booty? we didn't know anything about that. We were just being ourselves, so if we disagreed, well, then we disagreed, and sometimes it got heated. To this day, in fact, as recently as 2 days ago, someone said to me, what's Terry Train really like? And I just have to say, what do you mean? All you have to do is listen. And they'd say, yeah, but that thing she – no, that's her. That's – we're ourselves.
I think the best part of that show was it was a cocktail party that was, or even a, just call it a party that was on the morning. It wasn't. You did a few stage bits, you know, a few pre-recorded things, but
right.
it really wasn't. It wasn't so processed. Or, and by the way, no disrespect to Boone and Erickson, they were, you know, really the number one radio show in America for a long time. The world changed. They came into a world of TV was Milton Berle when they came into radio, and they left radio when the internet, video started popping out. So it's a very wide span of radio.
Yeah.
And I know that people that are still used to a Boone and Erickson style radio show, and they dial over, for example, my parents, and they dial over to KQRS when I had that blaring on the radio. They said, what is this? What are you listening to? This is people are not being nice to one another.
Yeah, and it can certainly be argued that things were a lot better, not just in radio, but in the world in general. Certainly in our world, things were a lot better when there was this thing called civility. It was grudging, but it was there, and it was expected in radio. And for a long time, it did pretty well. But, yeah, the world did change, and I think we reflected that as much as anything else. I don't think we were ahead of the curve, but I think the market was waiting for a show in which people just acted like themselves.
Let's take a quick break here on Flashback Twin Cities on KLDB Club 1220. Our guest today, Mike Gelfand, formerly of KQRS, formerly of the Minneapolis Tribune, and also a widely published author, as we read some titles just a little while ago. Let's talk a little bit about your journey to KQRS, because, again, radio journeys tend not to be as traditional as Brown College wants you to think they are. A lot of the top people in radio have stumbled upon it.
Yeah, you can go to school to learn about radio, and some people do really well doing that. But I think that as often as not, the people who are really successful are not the ones who ever plan to go into radio. And one reason, I think, is that it helps to have a fairly broad perspective of the world. And so I think that when you kind of fail into radio, as I always call it, I think that sometimes you're in a little better position. But mine was totally accidental. I got to know Tom during that period I talked about, when I was writing the gynecology newsletter, and I was writing the pro football column, and I was writing speeches for a life insurance company, and that sort of thing. During that period, I was also stringing, which means being a correspondent for Advertising Age. And I wound up writing a story about this new hot voiceover guy in town named Tom Bernard, and we hit it off. We got to be good friends, and it so happened that I certainly didn't know it when I approached him, but it happened that he was preparing to take over the morning show on KQRS. Ironically, because this is a small town, one of the people who was being bounced off the morning show was a guy by the name of Mark Zelenovich, who would just then become my partner. We were doing radio spots together, and of course, eventually we did the Stretch and Z show. So there's sort of a circular incestuous effect here. But anyway, I got to be friends with Tom, and then at the same time, the racetrack had just opened, and I'd go out there and I'd call in a tip to Tom. Mostly it was an excuse to make a joke or two. Pretty soon, I started doing football picks, and I would do like 5 minutes over the phone with him, and then pretty soon I started coming in for the picks, and he'd say, "Oh, stick around." I'd stick around for an hour. Pretty soon I was sticking around for the rest of the morning, and then after that it was 2 days and 3 days and 4 days and 5 days a week, and so at the end it was back to three. But
and that was an era that keep in mind that Canterbury was going to be the end all to all of our state budget issues, and I have tons of video on tcmedianow.com of Canterbury. I mean, it was. You had every dignitary, I mean the media, there the day it opened. You know, Steve Sharon, Sidney Bricado, Dave Moore, they're all down there, you know, trying to pick the first race, and everyone was promoting Canterbury Downs as, you know, it goes from Disney World, Canterbury Downs, things you want to do as a family.
Oh, tremendous. And, of course, Canterbury was built on this huge scale with huge expectations, and the track was getting basically capacity crowds that first year. It was a great palace, and then the second year, of course, the Mystic Lake Casino came in down the road, and by the third year, things had kind of started to go bad, and then that was part of the arc that finally hit the nadir in, I think it was 92 when the track closed for a couple of years.
And you're still a fan of the track, correct? You're still a supporter?
Well, I love the racetrack. And I actually, it was just this year that I stopped doing a gig out there. I was doing, going back to the mid to late 60s, I started doing a handicapping show out of the Canterbury Inn, the hotel across the street. Mm-hmm. And in those days, at the peak, there were like something like 150 racing days a year. So I was out there 150 days a year doing the show at the hotel. So it was a pretty big deal and a pretty big part, actually, of my income. And then over the years, I kept scaling back. The thrill was kind of gone, but I still love horse racing. But I was still doing, through last year, I was doing one day a week. And then this was the first year I wasn't out there doing a gig, basically, since the second year.
That's amazing.
I did not find it that hard to go cold turkey. I still love horse racing. I still love Canterbury. But I actually never went out there this year.
It's, I've been up myself a few times. It's still a nice track. You know, people want to find
terrific.
A day to do. It's tough, though, to get people to, you know, go up there and spend the time to gamble your money versus go to a casino or go somewhere where it's instant gratification. But there's still, the Kentucky Derby is still in existence, and there's something about horse racing that's still quite classic and very American.
Yeah, and for a lot of people around here, Canterbury Park is kind of like what the Empire State Building is like to people who live in New York. They may never have seen it. And they go out there and they discover it's a pretty cool place. Yeah, there's nothing like Canterbury around here. And it's scaled down and there's only 63 days of racing or something like that. Purses aren't as big as they were the first year, but they've really had an uptick in the last couple of years. And they're going strong. It's a great place. And I used to say that if the racetrack hadn't ruined my marriage, nothing good would have come of it. But that was just a joke.
I'm sure your ex-wife appreciates that.
It was kind of an obsessive thing. You know, it's when you get into horse racing, the thing if you really get into horse racing, if you go out to the track and you just fall in love with it, one of the things that you're going to love the most about it is. You have this feeling of, oh, wow, this is great because I'm never going to fully understand this. And
right.
That's charm. That's the power of it.
Right. Unlike those that play blackjack and craps who believe
right.
they've mastered the game and believe they've found a way to be able to make thousands of dollars every day.
Right, and everybody does the same thing. There's nothing creative about it. There's no new angles. Once you've learned it, and at that point, you either accept that as being something that you'd like to keep doing, or you say, I'm bored. And I used to play poker every once in a great while out at the racetrack, and of course, the poker room's a lot of fun, too, but I came to the conclusion that I would rather lose money betting on horses than win it playing poker.
Right. Our guest today, Mike Gelfand, former KQRS Morning Show personality, handicapper, and author. On the KQ Morning Show, we talked about it again. You're there 5 days a week. And the show didn't start out to be it was more of a sports show. You were doing picks. They were talking a lot about the Twins, and they were taking an approach to talk about sports, which had not been done. Again, we had sports on CCO radio since the beginning of time, but it was the very celebratory things are great, go team go. Tom Bernard, yourself, others on the show took a very critical approach to reporting on sports, which was unprecedented here, and that's where I believe the show took off. I'm sure you'd probably at least partly agree with that.
Well, I had been a sports reporter for a few years. I'd covered the Twins. So my approach was more of a clinical approach. It's just like the old thing about I want you, never want to see your sausage being made because you don't have a real taste for it after that, or your laws, as the expression goes. Well, I had seen and smelled the nauseous fumes of locker rooms for a number of years, and so there really wasn't much romance for me. And as a sports reporter in particular, I, of course, hard to believe, but not everyone in the locker room liked me. because I did have kind of a caustic approach, and the Twins were not good in the years I covered them. And there were a lot of guys on the team and the manager, Gene Mauch at the time, who I really liked, but generally maybe I wasn't quite as fawning and obsequious about the superstars as some people were. When they named a street Killebrew Drive after the legend Harmon Killebrew, I suggested that they name a street after the superstar. When I covered the team, I said there should be after Rod Carew, a psychopath. Well. And so that kind of thing didn't win me any friends. And look, believe me, I look back at that. I was an angry guy, and Rod was a little angry himself, and I wasn't fair to him at all. But then again, you know, he did threaten to kill me every day.
Well, so, I mean, beyond that,
But I don't blame him for it. I mean, he wasn't used to the kind of treatment that I gave him, and I've mellowed a bit. I wouldn't be here if I hadn't mellowed a bit. But my approach was pretty caustic. Now Tom was just he was a typical fan. Yeah. You know, he loved the team, but if someone on the team let him down, he'd be pretty vocal about it. So we had different approaches, but still they were our approach, and we didn't we had a rule pretty much throughout the run of the show that we didn't interview athletes.
No.
We didn't have them on our show. Now, that rule was violated sometimes to our detriment, but that was because we wanted to be able to speak the way we spoke about them. We didn't want to have to tiptoe around, and the listeners really bought into that because we said the same things they did. And Tom, nobody cheered louder than Tom when the Twins won the World Series, and nobody booed louder when they were 20 games under. So, again, a very sincere, genuine approach, and it clicked. And in those early years, we were really going hard after the young male demo. That was where it was at in those days. And we called the format. I called the format Jock Rock, because we'd you know, we talk a lot about sports, and then of course we had the twice an hour we would play music. Generally, it would be, of course, Against the Wind,
sure,
by Seeger, and then maybe throw in a Heart double shot occasionally. And I can tell you one thing is that no matter how much you like Against the Wind, when you've heard it 3 to 4 days a week for 25 years, you don't want to hear it again.
Is there any song that, I mean, the playlist has not changed? We've had Alan Stone on the show before, and he's quite impressed the playlist hasn't changed too much since he created it in 1968.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a little more psychedelic when Alan Stone first came on. You know, Alan was probably the first of the kind of classic mellow FM jocks in town. At least that's the way I remember him. When KQ in the mid 60s and the late 60s was really went with that psychedelic sound. I mean, he was the voice of it. I once heard Alan Stone say, and this was probably about 1968, I heard Alan Stone say, it's about 8 o'clock if you're into that time thing.
It's a quote that he is proud of saying because many people have come up to him and asked him about that quote. And,
really? Have they really?
That's
fantastic, because I never actually heard anyone else say they heard it.
Well, when they do the KQ Jocks days like they do in Chicago, they bring all the old jocks in, maybe you guys will share air shift together and talk about that time thing.
Sure.
The show merged from sports to then talk. I mean, talk not only about sports, but talked about news and politics, which really I think is kind of where the show got very interesting and then became controversial. Minnesota was a changing place. A lot of things happened in the news that these small stories, which probably would have been back page items or even front page for a day, comments made on the show took life and took months to shake off.
Oh, yeah. The hurts were deep and the resentments genuine. And I always say that I found myself in the space of a couple of George Bush years transitioning from the voice of reason to the voice of treason. Because I was kind of a lone wolf in those days. I thought it was important that somebody speak out, not only in opposition to the Bush years, to offer another opinion, but also I didn't want all the liberals to stop listening to the show. But, you know, it got strident, and it got less entertaining. There's no question about it. People, one of the things that, humbled me was discovering that my refreshing opposition to the conservative voice of the show really wasn't much appreciated. Not so much because of what I believed in, but just because of the fact that people really weren't listening for that. They wanted to be entertained. They wanted me to tell them jokes and say funny things. And in the end, that was my job on the show, was to be the satirical sniper. I was supposed to sit on the rooftop, look through my scope, and when I saw an opportunity, fire a bullet.
And Terry Tran provided you many opportunities to do that.
Sometimes there's just nothing you can say when Terry would come up with one of her classic lines. I mean, you know, talking to the ship reclamation expert.
Those that don't know the show, you know, Tom Bernard, and you know, he does not claim to be a conservative, and I think that Tom has a very, I think, has a broad range of opinions, a broad range of from where he came from. But you were, in a sense, and much like just the way media went. I mean, media, everyone had to pick which side they were on, especially in the cable news era, which evolved during the time of the show. You were coined as the liberal guy or as the lefty guy and that's really what your role, in a sense, right or wrong, became for a while. And then, of course, that needed to change, too, according to you or according to station management.
Yeah, it had we couldn't go on the way we were going. The show was just not all that entertaining all the time. Anger is going to work for a short amount of time, and sometimes the arguments are kind of fun. But look, we lived then and now in really such a polarized world, and as you say, it's you see those bunker mentalities every day now, cable TV and then on the internet and Twitter. There's not a lot of moderation there. There's not a lot of people who are saying, well, I agree with you on this, but him on that.
No.
It's like there are no innocent bystanders anymore. And so I think perhaps there, again, we might have reflected the mood of the times, but I think that a morning show in particular, that was an occasion for people to get away from that and to just have some laughs. That was what I was picking up when I talked to listeners. And I think probably the research, which is pretty scrupulous in radio, if you're successful, it's going to be, I think that was indicating the same thing, when people were tired of the stridency.
Well, I think there's the way politics became in the 2000s, there just needed to be some bit of escape to not have to listen to four different boxes of people talking about their opinion. And the thing that I always found fascinating about cable news, and not so much, not, you know, the morning show, but it's just these statements come out, and there's actually no facts behind them. There's no,
no.
It's all feeling, and of course, people take that as fact.
A lot of people passing on what they heard from someone else. A lot of urban myths. Urban myths is always huge, and I think it got to be much bigger in those days, with people calling in saying things like, you know, the immigrants get free health insurance, and that sort of thing. Nothing really behind it, but a lot of myths that somehow overnight turned into reality. And that's really the forum. The medium is not designed to offer moderate exchanges of opinion and inquiry. That's just not what it's about.
We'll take a quick break here. I want to come back, and I have some audio from Stretch and Z we'll play when we come back here on
great
Flashback Twin Cities here on KLDB Club 1220. Cities, Tom Osmond with our guest today, Mike Gelfand. Mike, we got some audio here from a show which I believe you are also a fan of with me. This is the Sports Friday with Stretch and Z. And Tom, I have some audio here I want to play here, so let's just go here.
This is Walter Cronkite. It started out innocently enough. A group of cable operators had organized a celebration to commemorate the last day of business for Sports Friday. As the group celebrated, hundreds of men looking for cheap thrills filed into the offices of Sports Friday, buying sale copies of the remaining Sports Friday videotapes. But then things turned ugly. Stretch and Z began to argue with the cable operators over the public's right to enjoy inflammatory, sensationalized programming. The rest is history. And that's the way it is.
Yes, there is a serious side to Sports Friday, and I think that's why so many of the major figures in sports today have agreed to come on the show and be subjected to our relentless grilling.
Well, of course, most of them with the proviso that the tape never run.
Yes, and or at least that no one ever be able to see it, and fortunately, most of the cable systems in the Twin Cities have accommodated that request.
It's been very nice of them, too, but now you get to see what they've been missing.
There you go. The best of Sports Friday.
John Gallus, when we started doing the show, of course, at, as you mentioned earlier, we were on the old MSC and Minnesota Sports Channel, and that was before it became Fox Sports, and so we were doing the show in the WCCO TV studio, and we're sitting there thinking, well, we need an announcer, we need a sidekick, a straight man. And just about that point, John Gallus walks by, a TV legend, John Gallus, who, of course, had been with Channel 4, I think, pretty much since the very early days. He'd come to fame as Clancy the Cop back when all the stations did Kid Show. Wonderful guy, just a marvelous sense of humor.
And also the host of the longest-running religious program, local religious program in history.
That's right. That's right. And so we said, John, you know, do you want to do this? And, of course, it was like, he'd pay us to do it. He was sitting there and didn't have much to do. And he became a real institution. And one of the first bits we did was a bit with Mark and I, to get inspired for bits, we would go to, like, the dollar store or someplace like that. And we'd find some bizarre object. One day we found this windsock that was in the shape of an owl. So we did this bit where we had, it involved John sprinting with the windsock around the lawn in front of the old WCCO TV building. And we really put him through the paces. He must have run about a half a mile doing sprints that day. And as we were wrapping up, one of the news producers came by and said, "That was great." He said, "I can't believe John did that." And we had no idea what he was doing. We were saying, "Why? Why? What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know, I mean, it was only 10 days ago he had open heart surgery."
Oh, God.
That was Gallus.
You know, hey, that's an era when the show must go on. Those guys did live TV hours a day. And, the news guys, you know, they did, you know, and by the way, not to, because we have a, you know, Stan Turner's our midday host, but they did, you know, three live shows a night. These guys that did TV in the kinescope era, live kids TV, he did 3 hours of kids TV a day, and a lot of it was improv. So,
hey, in the early days, they literally, on the news shows, had to send the film to the drugstore to get developed.
It's and by the way, my question for you is, I always knew John Gallus. I was not of the Clancy era. I kind of missed that by a couple of years, but I knew him as the announcer and also from hosting the religious program on Sunday mornings. I wonder, some of the humor of Stretch and Z could be...
We always worried about that. There was some kind of a little bit racy stuff. But he Gallus, you know, he loved the camera and he always went with it. So every now and then he'd say, "Oh, I can't do that voice." But it was pretty rare. The one thing that was a pain in the butt with Gallus is we'd be sitting around and say, "Well, now what are we going to do?" You know, on that 8:40 block. And John would always say, "Well, I can recite Who's on First." And we basically put him off for about 2 years, but finally toward the end of the show's run, we said, "John, we want you to do Who's on First tonight." And I think that somewhere in the grave, John is still reciting Who's on First.
And the show was on off and on for about 3 years, correct?
Yeah, we bounced around because what happened was eventually MSC... lost all of it. They brought in a guy named Kevin Couture, who was a bean counter, and Kevin decided that the all our affiliates needed to pay us more to carry the show. Well, at that time, MSC didn't have the things they have today. They had no sports programming. Actually, they had no games. I'm not, you know, they may have had the putt-putt tournament or something like that. That was actually in the early days of cable, like the putt-putt. The putt-putt tournament was considered a major get. The I remember watching that. That was one of my favorite shows, actually, was the putt-putt tournament, because the announcer would, you know, you'd see this guy who probably was a, you know, he's an ordinary guy. He still might have had his plumber uniform on, because he went right from the job. You know, and they'd say, Watson lines up the putt. It's a beautiful stroke. It hits the clown. It bounces off the windmill. And, oh, he missed! He's going to have to take a two! So it was a different era.
I think that ball ends up in the backyard of Paul Douglas, too. And that video just might find its way to tcmedianow.com in the very near future, because I may have found that tape recently.
Well, that's gold. I want to see that one. Yeah, we decided to we did a golf segment, and we decided to have a pro kind of give us some tips. And we went over to the, it's the Brookview court, right?
Right.
I'm a tennis player. The Brookview golf course, and it adjoins Channel 11. And so we went in, we just walked in there, barged in about 3 in the afternoon, and we found Douglas and say, hey, pretend you're doing the weather for us, the backyard weather. So they set up the lights and got the cameraman in there, and he pretended that he was doing it, and then we, of course, threw the golf ball, and it bounced at his feet, and I played through.
It's a good thing the KQ Morning Show have been so kind to Paul Douglas over the years, too, when he agreed to do that, because you guys have been his best friends. I have one more clip here from Stretch and Z I want to play, then I have to ask you about what you're doing nowadays. And this one is a little risque, but I think that because it's our former guest, Neil Murray, is in this, we can play this one.
But did they feel like a sneaker? Let's take a look.
They're playing basketball in high heels, like Edith Bird.
We asked a panel of basketball experts to evaluate our experts on the basketball court. After watching them play, the jury was hung, which was more than we could say for, well, you get the picture. All in all, we found only fair performance. Our experts could shake, but they couldn't bake. They could do that thing, but they just couldn't jam. In short, pumps or no pumps, they still suffered from a terminal case of white man's disease. I'm Neil Murray. On your behalf, Whit.
And you can see that on tcmedianow.com, our On Behalf reporter, Neil Murray.
Yeah,
and Stretch,
of course,
in high heels.
Of course, we took advantage of two media phenomena there. We had the Neil Murray, of course, was the host of the wildly popular On Your Behalf segment on Channel 5. And at that time, The looks like a pump, feels like a sneaker campaign was going full tilt, and that of course was a red shoe that was the slogan speaks for itself. So Z and I put on the red pumps, and we went down to the one of the local playgrounds and played basketball. And there's a shot in there with a great visual. It's the local. This was in the south side, as I recall. And great shot of the local kids staring at this. Believe in disbelief as these two stupid white guys were playing basketball and pumps. I think, as I recall, I put on a really good between the legs shake and bake move.
It's fantastic, and I hate to admit it. I actually had to go back and watch that Easy Spirit commercial with the young ladies playing basketball in high heels. And
there's
something about it that's very mesmerizing. I don't know. I'm sorry to say, guys, but you watch these. They're playing, you know, full on basketball in high heels. I got to ask before we run out of time here. Morning show. You left the morning show about 3 years ago. I'm sure you had a lot of questions. What are you up to now? I know you retired from radio, but what is it you do now?
Yeah, you know, I left radio. It was a fun job, and I would have loved to have done it forever, but I had and still have a sleep disorder, and basically called delayed sleep phase syndrome. I can't really get up before noon, which means that my bedtime was usually right around the time that I had to go in and do the show. And so 25 years of not getting sleep will definitely take its toll on you. And plus, at that time, my dad had just gone into assisted living, and his dementia was getting worse. So since I had to basically take care of my dad and go see him every day.
Lou Gelfand of the Minneapolis Star Tribune.
Lou Gelfand, the former ombudsman for the paper, I decided that I was going to write a book, a memoir about my life, but really concentrating quite a bit on my dad's dementia years, because I had this great opportunity to be with him and track his dementia every day. And obviously it's something that I don't know if I've met anyone lately who hasn't been touched by it. If it's not your parents, it's your grandparents, it's your aunt, someone in your family or some good friend has dementia. And we're just learning more and more about it. So I wanted to kind of speak from the perspective of someone among, you know, many people in this country going through this process. And I wanted to learn more. And I would visit my dad every day, and I would always take an audio recorder. So I had hundreds of hours of conversations with him, and, you know, some of which finds its way into the book. And it's been a fascinating journey for me writing, and I'm still pecking away at the book, and I'm still learning things. And it's been fascinating. I've learned a lot of things about my family history. It's no secret I've talked openly about the fact that I've suffered from depression since I was probably 8 or 9 years old. My brother committed suicide. He suffered from depression, obviously. And I discovered that this was in every branch of my family tree. The book is not a bummer book. It's not devoted to depression
and
people killing themselves, but it's a part of the story. And actually, what I always said about Stretch and Z, the philosophy I had for the show is what I try to adopt with the book, which is that you come for the laughter and you stay for the tears.
I think that's a great philosophy. We may use it on Flashback Twin Cities. We may coin that. And by the way, we'll be waiting to hear back on that book project. Do you have? I'm sure you get a lot of questions from people randomly who recognize your voice and ask you what you're up to. Do you anticipate the next year or two the book is ready? Or
yeah, I think hopefully I'll be done maybe 6 months or so. But the process can be a pretty long one, and the book business isn't exactly real crazy now. But the great thing about the book is if it doesn't become a book of national interest, I'm sure it will still be a book of local interest. So
right.
I think I'll probably wind up getting it published. But I have to say, it's been a year since my dad died. Actually, it will be, oh my goodness, yeah, it's been a year today. This is the anniversary of his death, and I'm still learning things. I'm looking at records and I'm learning things. It wasn't that long ago that I found out I had a great aunt who wound up, she was depressed. She wound up in one of the state asylums. You know, this state of Minnesota had this labyrinth of institutions with names like the Asylum for Idiots and Imbeciles, for example.
Well, it was the era where they were holding cells. They weren't treatment centers. They were holding cells.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes assisted living places aren't much more than holding cells either. But these were bad places, and it was not unusual for the inmates to be lobotomized, to get shock treatment. So I found out that my great aunt, first of all, I found out she existed because I didn't know she existed. My family, while suffering from all these problems, wasn't any different from most. They didn't talk about it. And my mother never mentioned her aunt's name to me, never, not once. And I only found out about her existence because I was looking at the ship registry from the ship that my mom's dad came over from Romania on, and his name was Aaron Lerner, and next to his signature was a signature for Sadie Lerner, and I thought, oh wow, you know, was that his wife? Who was that? And of course, looking in more detail, I found her death certificate, found out she had spent something like 40 years in these institutions.
That's amazing. I mean, it's amazing the things your family tree to look to find where you came from, and you find these other secrets that sometimes gives you a mapping of, you know, who you became. I apologize, we don't have a lot of time left today, but I want to thank you. I've always appreciated your honesty, your humor, and willingness to talk about your life and your career. And again, your humor is missed by me and many other people, and I hope that we'll be able to see you in other projects very soon.
Well, they will. And, you know, I have to say, I'm either the luckiest unlucky person in the world, or it could be the other way around. But, you know, it's been a great ride for me, being able to having the opportunity to work for newspapers and do radio shows and TV shows, and people, for some reason I've never been able to perceive, people in this community have been really good to me.
Well, Stretch and Z is now can be seen 24 hours a day anywhere in the world on tcmedianow.com. So we have a few episodes. And
I've been watching it lately myself. I've been online watching it. It's great. I have to thank you for keeping those videos alive.
Well, we'll keep doing it. Again, Mike Gelfand, formerly KQRS Morning Show, and a soon-to-be a new book coming out. This is Flashback Twin Cities here on KLDB Club 1220.